All right, so good afternoon and welcome back. This is our annual budget concepts meeting. We will be considering concepts today for the 23-24 budget. And also, this is our first time back in 2 years. It's nice to see everybody, and this is actually a hybrid meeting, and so we'll see how this format works for us. It looks like so far it's going great. And so everyone who's joining us, welcome, and any member of the public who has constructive criticism about the hybrid meeting that we can maybe incorporate to the next one, that would be great. So thank you all for being here, and thank you for all of you who came in person. It's great to see you. I remember you all as shorter, you're taller than I remember, so that's great. That's good news. Let's keep that up. All right, this meeting is being conducted via video conference, and it is being recorded. That means members of the public can watch this meeting via a listen-only video feed. As a reminder, members may need to view materials for this meeting and watch. Oh, as a reminder to the public, our members are going to be required, especially in this meeting, where there's a lot of bits and pieces that have to be looked at and studied. We're going to be looking at materials on different screens and different devices. So at times you'll find the budget members and staff will be facing away from the camera, looking down and looking at the screens. To budget committee members and any others who are speaking either via video or calling in, for the benefit of the public, one, please remember to unmute yourself before you begin speaking, and then two, before you begin speaking, please identify yourselves. Great. Ms. Cowan, can you take a roll?
Judge Rubin.
I am here.
Judge Mormon. Present. Judge Bakke.
Judge Bakke called me and he's unable to join us today.
Thank you. Justice Fujisaki.
Here.
Justice Hill.
Present.
Judge Hawk.
Here.
Mr. Harrigan.
Present by blue jeans.
Six of seven members.
Outstanding work. So let's first do the minutes from December 7 and March 9.
I move to approve both sets.
Thank you. Second. All right, we have a motion by Mormon, second by Hoff. Any further discussion? All right, hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain. All right. It passes unanimously. Ms. Cowan, public comment, please.
We have no written public comments for this meeting.
All right. That does conclude the public comment portion of this meeting. And now we're going on to the next item. Our first action item is a court-appointed counsel funding. Judge Conklin? I said BCPs. Here we go. Budget change concepts, Just trying to test you. Now, I'm using a sports analogy. I see you, Conklin, trying to say something, but luckily you're muted, so I cannot hear your comment.
I better not be. I'm not muted on my end.
Uh-huh. No, you are. Now I can hear you, sadly. All right.
Thanks.
What we're going to do is Judge Conklin is in trial right now. And so what we're going to do before we kind of get into it, we started late. He needs to get back. So I'm going to ask him to take up the tick back items so he can get back to his courtroom, and I'll go back and kind of do a little more of an introduction. But real quickly, this is our budget change concepts meeting. Everyone's seen and gotten the materials on this. So go ahead.
So thank you, Judge Rubin, and your sports analogy, I assume, is you're changing the batting order, and I appreciate that.
No, well,
bat out of order.
Yeah.
So thanks for your time, folks. I'm sorry I can't be there in person. As Judge Rubin said, I'm in trial. I'll keep this brief. I think you know, but the procedure that the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee utilizes to develop our budget change proposals is that each member of TICBAC reaches out to other court executive officers and presiding judges throughout the state to liaison to get their perceptions about their priorities for budget change proposals. We then have a meeting with the entire committee. in which we vet these and discuss these proposals. It's a vibrant meeting. Everybody is very candid in their recommendations of BCPs. We typically obtain 20 to 30 suggestions. We then have a vote and we come up with our top priorities, which you now have before you. So of all the BCP recommendations that came to the committee after consideration, the members felt that the four before you were the most significant to present in order. And so they are ranked. The number one is the one that is coincidentally a version of included in the governor's budget, and that's the annual automatic inflationary adjustment for trial courts. We're hoping that that'll be, and I know John Wardlaw does a better job, or Zlotko, defining the particularities of these, but we hope to make it an ongoing budget item for annual funding. And that's what the group felt was the first and most important BCP. The next, the following three get a little more technical. The automatic adjustment is basically one that's linked to the CPI. And so for lack of a better description, it's an inflationary adjustment to address the increased costs that we all have every year. Number two is to address the trial court civil assessment revenue shift and backfill. As I think you're all aware, civil assessments have always been a moving target, so to speak, in the sense of how long do they continue? How useful are they to the courts as contrasted to the impact they might have on those folks who have to pay the civil assessments, which may lead to the elimination of that revenue to the courts, which be extremely important to the courts to be able to fill. So the hope is that there is a BCP approved that would create a civil assessment revenue shift and backfill to the courts. The third is one we recognize may be a significant ask. We recognize that the governor's budget this year is very generous, so to speak, and effective for the trial courts. So we do recognize that timing to this is a consideration, but we also think it's important that this remain at the forefront, and that is the workload formula gap funding to 100%, which simply stating, if passed, would bring all the trial courts up to 100% of the funding needed to address their workload. And then finally, the fourth one is related to, and that's on the first page, I believe, the trial court civil assessment maintenance of effort, commonly referred to as MOEs. This is a more intricate and detailed even than the other ones. MOEs are some ongoing obligations, maintenance of effort that 38 of our 58 sister courts are obligated to address out of their general fund revenue every year to address ongoing debt related to what we call maintenance of effort. This has been requested numerous times. We think it's important and we think it's timely that it go forward this time as well. To relieve the trial courts of their maintenance of effort obligations would be a significant assist to the courts, the 38 of the 58, they'd have to cover it out of their general fund. So I realize that's a very high flyover. Judge Rubin, did I hear you have a question?
I started to, which was on item three.
Right.
I saw the BCC. You're seeking truly a 100% by workload funding, correct?
That is our aspiration.
Okay. I did listen to the meeting, and I'm going to confess I don't remember the conversations around everything, but I just from my perspective is that depending on where you put the work year, right? We're probably in the 90s, right?
Yep, absolutely. And this, I hear you both directly and your concern, and I that is an appropriate perspective. And that's why I tried to emphasize that we do recognize that timing is a consideration here. You're right, Judge Rubin, depending on how you consider the funding gap and where we are, most courts could be upwards of 90%. And so I want to be careful here because I'm speaking as the chair, but there was all the members of TICBAC had a voice in this, so I'm speaking somewhat independently, but I do recognize that the funding level that we have currently been able to secure through the hard efforts of the administration is more than beneficial to the courts and appreciated. As I said before, it's always just an aspirational goal that someday we have the money we need, all the money we need to conduct business, but things sure have gotten better. I don't know if that addresses your concern.
It does, in the sense of it reflects some realism. Does anybody else want to, while we've got Judge Conklin here, let's ask some questions. Judge Hopp.
Yeah, Judge Conklin, could you explain the relationship, if there is one, between funding to provide all trial courts to 100% and funding to address general inflationary cost increases? Because I noticed that those both are rather significant amounts. They're not the same, but they're kind of similar when compared to the other things. Is there a relationship between those two? In other words, if we got the general inflationary increase, would that help narrow the gap on the 100%?
Well, it's more money, and so it would. John or Zlatko could probably drill down a little better than this than I can. But the analogy that we've used in the past is that the inflationary cost adjustment is to address costs that all courts have, regardless of their funding level, for costs that go up every year. And we've always used the analogy of postal stamps. I think we should probably use the analogy of gasoline now, as we have to pay for that. That all comes out of our general fund. So as those prices that every trial court experiences go up, the inflationary adjustment accounts for that. The budget, the gap is a little more particular to each trial court, and that some courts are below average funding, some courts are above average funding. And again, I'm trying to be candid and transparent. It has gotten much better. There's no doubt about that. Through the efforts of the chief and Martin and John and Zlatko and numerous others, we've seen significant improvement. We just don't want to lose sight of it. So my perception of the discussion at TICBAC was, let's keep this at least alive so the ask doesn't evaporate.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Judge Conklin before we lose him to his day job? All right, Judge Conklin, thank you for, I know how difficult it is as a trial judge myself to not have the lunch hour to work on the trial that's coming up. And we appreciate that you took the time to be with us. So thank you.
You bet. And I'm really looking forward to being in the room on Friday. I'm sorry I can't make it up before tomorrow night, but I'm so looking forward to being face to face, if not mask to mask, with all of you on Friday morning.
All right.
Be safe and be well. All right. Thanks. Bye bye.
All right. Let's now kind of get back to the top. So just for the public that's listening, so we have our process is this. So this is our first meeting on the 23-24 budget change concept. We're not doing a decision today, but we did want to at least learn about the proposals themselves, the proposals. Then from there, we have a second meeting where we'll talk more about them and make more kind of cuts. And then from there, we'll present this at the July meeting. That's kind of the essence of it. We do have a setup here. We're going to go in order. So we've taken, took back out of order just to accommodate them. I see we have Kareen Alvarado on the screen to talk about items 01 and 02. So take a moment to pull those up. All right, Ms. Alvarado.
I'm Kareen Alvarado, the director of CGER. CGER has two budget change proposal concepts in front of you today. One is for a video media producer, and one is for a web media producer. Basically, we currently have three video media producers and two web producers, and we're asking for one more of each of them. The video media producers create education videos, and the web producers manage the education website, CGER Online, and they also program online courses. They do that complicated computer programming work. Basically, back in the 1980s, video media producers filmed in-person courses, and we put them on VHS tapes and actually mailed VHS tapes to judges who weren't able to attend a particular in-person course or program. In the early 2000s, we built a production studio in the Judicial Council's San Francisco offices, and we installed satellite downlink sites in at least one courthouse in every county. We started offering education for both judges and court personnel via live satellite broadcast, and our video media producers ran the cameras, ran the studio, did the splitting and any kind of editing that was needed. Over the years, demand for distance education has increased. Happily, internet bandwidth has increased as well, and we shifted from filming live satellite broadcasts to filming videos and uploading them to the education website, Seizure Online. This change required us to edit the videos after filming, which of course increased the demand on the resource, the video media producers. The number of videos that we produce has risen steadily over the years as the demand for distance education has increased. The video media producers also are responsible for filming vignettes that are used in in-person courses by faculty. One example that's familiar to judges is the vignettes in the Qualifying Ethics Core course that judges take every 3 years. And there are lots of other courses that use the vignettes as well. The video media producers spend time filming and editing legacy videos for the Appellate Court Legacy Project. And once webcasting became available to the branch, to everybody, CJR video media producers started handling the video work for webcasts of judicial council meetings, POJA hearings, and more recently, California Supreme Court hearings. You can see that the workload of the video media producers has increased and continued to increase over the past several decades. Entire time, we've only had three video media producer positions, and the demand for video products has increased exponentially in that same amount of time. So an additional video media producer position is necessary for us to continue to be able to meet not only the demand for educational video products, but also for the video production needs of the Supreme Court, the Courts of Appeal, and the Chief Justice. The story is the same for the web media producer position that we are requesting. CJR has had two web media producers for over 20 years, while during that time, online education resources have continued to grow. As the number of education resources on CJR Online continues to increase, as an example, we've got over 700 videos on CJR Online, 125 podcasts, 81 online courses, 200 different publications, including job aids, and additional resources and reference materials, including reference materials from our in-person courses that are posted on CJR Online and made available to the branch. Simply maintaining the website has become a priority for these two web media producer positions. As a result, our ability to program new online courses and update existing online courses has been almost eliminated. And at the same time, demand for those online courses continues to grow. So an additional web media producer position will enable CJR to continue to maintain this rich array of education resources already on CJR Online to ensure that the site remains accessible and user-friendly and provide needed online education services in a cost-effective manner for the courts while continuing to expand online course offerings. That's my presentation. Are there any questions about that?
Questions from staff or members?
I have a question.
Yes, we have a question. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So I think you answered it. Did you say for 20 years up until like the present moment, you've only had two, CJR's only had two web producers? Is that two web producers in each category or two web producers, period?
Two web producers, period, at CJR, maintaining all of CJR Online and programming online new online courses and updating existing online.
And then I have a different question. Can I go ahead?
Yeah.
The proposed salary, do you think it's competitive for the market?
I am not prepared to speak on that. I don't know. We haven't, it's been a number of years since we hired somebody, and we've got folks in the position with some longevity. So I'm not prepared to answer that question. I'd have to research it for you.
Okay. Those are my questions. Thank you.
More questions? Thank you, Ms. Alvarado. That's outstanding.
Thank you.
All right. We have Ms. Byrne on the collaborative justice piece.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for letting me be here. I am, my name is Francine Byrne. I'm a principal manager with the Criminal Justice Services. And these proposals may look a little familiar to you because they're a little similar to what we presented last year that did not actually get included into the governor's January budget. But it turns out there are still a few people that have behavioral health issues in the court system. As far as we know, we have not been able to fix everybody. So we're going to ask again for these things. There's two projects. I won't go into a lot of detail because you have seen them. I'm happy to answer questions. But I'll give you a really very brief overview of the things that we are asking. One relates to collaborative justice courts. There, as you may know, there was state funding for these programs quite some time ago. That got subsumed and realigned to counties in 2011. And so what this funding would do would be to replace the court portion of the previous statewide funding that was there. So the courts put in a lot of extra work in their collaborative court programs, hearing costs, coordinators, back room, a lot of coordination and that sort of thing. They've also been increasingly asked in the last several years to implement diversion programs that end up, it sounds like, in the court system are often going towards the collaborative court judges and teams because many of them relate to behavioral health issues. So we're hoping that this funding can be used to replenish those the collaborative court system. And also it will be used to encourage a larger caseload size. We hear that a lot of courts are keep very small caseload sizes, keeping them those kind of specialty courts, in part because there's no funding, there's not enough dedicated and stable funding for them to really expand. So this would be an opportunity for us to encourage and really actually sort of mandate that expansion because the funding would be related to the caseload sizes and the number of cases that are processed through the collaborative courts. So it does go roughly, it would allow courts to hire more coordinators and to offset any kind of backroom costs and what have you. It also has a large data collection component, leveraging some of the lessons we've learned and resources that have been gathered in some other programs, our pretrial pilot, for example. So it would finally create kind of a statewide collaborative court data collection system as well and reporting. So that's the first one. Are there any questions about the collaborative court one before I move on?
Any questions on item 03? Yes, Justice Fujisaki.
Hi, Francine.
Oh, hi, Justice Fujisaki. How are you?
Hi, good, good. So this might be off base, but so the governor just announced his CARE program, right? This proposal was drafted before that announcement. Is there kind of overlap, intersection?
I think that remains to be seen, but it's an excellent question. We are definitely working on sort of understanding that more about that and how these things would work together. That right now is very clearly a civil court process. So in that sense, it would be different. In the sense that people are tapping into behavioral health resources as part of the court program, I think there's a lot of overlap, but right now I'm not seeing doesn't look like it's a complete overlap, but we are definitely tracking the two together.
All right.
Judge Rubin?
Yes.
So, Francine, with regard to the governor's unveiling of the CARES, over the next couple of months, this is not a decision meeting. As you guys are looking at that, can you inform the committee as we go into the May time period whether or not there is any overlap here?
Absolutely. That's a good point.
All right, how about item 04?
And actually, that's perfect timing, because part of the CARE program may actually overlap a bit with this next item. Actually, it's unclear, but it may. So this is related to incompetent to stand trial. The number of findings or doubts that have been declared has gone way up, continues to go up. It's been increasing substantially over the last, really far before COVID. It had been increasing pretty rapidly, the number of evaluations that the courts need to conduct. And there has not been any dedicated funding for that. So it's coming out of the court's general fund. And we've done some research on it and found that most of the courts are not really able to pay a very competitive rate, and that there has not been a lot of any statewide resources for the courts to identify these evaluators, to make sure that the reports are properly created, and that there's enough enough effort going into them. And the courts are almost all of them are saying that they're struggling to find at least the psychiatrists that are, you have to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So it's been quite a struggle. So we are proposing to have about $10 million, which wouldn't even cover the entire cost of evaluators that are necessary in the state, but what it would cover is the increase in cost that we've seen over the last few years. And it also would create this program that would help the courts to identify evaluators. We would centralize some of these activities if the courts want us to make sure that the prices being paid for evaluations can be a little more standardized. Right now, they are completely varied. The rural courts struggle so hard to find these folks that sometimes they'll pay up to $3,000, we've heard. You know, some courts can pay $500. So there's definitely some equality issues and some issues related to recruitment. So we're hoping that this funding will not only, most of it goes to the courts to offset those costs, but then a portion would go to help us provide resources as well for the courts for those evaluators. And this may or may not overlap with the CARE program as well, and we'd be happy to come back and once we know how, if and how it does.
Zlatko.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Rubin. Just want to let the committee know that this is an issue that, as we, Francine said, not funded in the governor's budget, even though we proposed it. However, the Department of Finance is continuing to look at that this issue this spring. So we're hopeful through the good work that Francine's doing to continue to support it. It may be something that we see funded this spring in the budget, and it may be then come off our list. So it's giving a little bit of an update on some of these ongoing issues as they go through the budget.
Are you talking about those?
The IST issue definitely is an issue, but we're obviously looking at the CARES court issue as it relates to our collaborative court issue as well.
And I guess, Ms. Byrne, I just had a question about item 04. So do we think that this issue affects, and you may have said this and I didn't catch it, smaller courts more and medium courts more than larger courts or counties, I should say, because like some counties I think have some of this in-house at their county mental health. And I'm just curious.
Yes, I do think that it's more of an issue in the rural courts finding folks than it is in the larger courts. But I think the funding and being able to, you know, support kind of a going rate for these things pretty much across the boards. There's economies of scale, and there's also programs such as Los Angeles partners with the medical school, one of the medical schools down there, to provide sort of a lower cost psychiatric residence that will help do it. We're also going to look into that if we get funded to create programs like that in other counties. But yes, I would definitely say that it's disproportionate towards the rural courts, but I think we haven't had any courts yet tell us that they feel like they have sufficient resources for this.
Thank you. Any other questions on item 04? All right, going to item, oh, thank you very much, Ms. Byrne. No, thing.
It's good seeing you all. Bye-bye, thanks.
Sure. All right. Moving now to items 05 through 010. Maybe Ms. McCormick, oh, there she is.
All right, Ms. Hello, Judge Rubin and members of the community. I'm Pella McCormick, Director of Facility Services. As many of you know, Facility Services is responsible for the council's real estate portfolio, which consists of more than 450 court facilities with over 2,150 courtrooms across the state and approximately 24 million square feet. The program's goal is to prolong asset usefulness in order to ensure reliable, safe, and functional court facilities for all Californians. The facilities program has initiated a multi-pronged strategy of robust preventative maintenance, reduction of deferred maintenance backlog, and replacement of substandard facilities. To further these goals, facilities has proposed 5 budget concepts for 23-24. Many of them will sound familiar as well. Proposal 2305, the trial court and court of appeal deferred maintenance requests 3 positions and $100.7 million ongoing. This is a repeat proposal from last year. 37% of our portfolio facilities are over 50 years old and nearing the end of their useful life. The deferred maintenance backlog is currently $5 billion with a $3.7 billion judicial council share. Deferred maintenance has been granted to the program every year since 1819, with the exception of the 22-23. And largely due to this infusion of cash, the deferred maintenance backlog has actually been reduced by more than $250 million. By supporting this proposal and continuing this trend of addressing the backlog, we can ensure that court facilities are reliable, safe, and functional. Proposal 2306, water conservation and leak detection measures in courthouses, requests $4 million one time and is a similar proposal from last year. This proposal would install leak detection equipment such as electronic flow meters and smart irrigation for water conservation measures in 160 JCC facilities. It provides an early warning of unusual water usage and also provides us with data to make decisions as far as how we can reduce water usage, which will reduce utility costs. It's also noteworthy that the most costly and expensive repairs occur in buildings that have suffered water damage, and an early warning will afford an opportunity to at least respond and reduce the number or the cost of these plumbing failures. Proposal 2307, facility modification, prioritization, and costs, requests $35 million ongoing and a $7 million in reimbursement authority to address facility modification and renewals in trial courts. This again is a repeat proposal from last year, noting a portion of last year's request is currently included in the governor's 22-23 budget. The portion being considered for 22-23 includes facility modification funding of $15.4 million ongoing, which if approved will be the first increase since 2014. However, in 24-25, facility modification funding will be reduced by $15 million when a 10-year augmentation expires, which reduces available funding in 24-25 back to the 2014 level. At the current funding level, the program is financially constrained to provide funding to only the top 2 of 6 tiers of project priorities. Currently, only emergency and critical projects are funded. The inability to perform infrastructure renewals will quickly reverse the gains in deferred maintenance backlog. Proposal 2308, new trial court facilities operation and maintenance, requests $6 million ongoing. This is a new proposal. This proposal requests an increase to the operations and maintenance funding to support 9 already completed or planned to be complete capital projects. The 9 projects are activating 113 courtrooms in 1.2 million square feet. And although many of these projects consolidate and deactivate antiquated court facilities and will result in long-term offsets of the O&M funding, in the short term, the program will continue to incur costs to maintain the closed facilities in a warm shutdown until the facility is sold or transferred to another entity. Proposal 2309, San Diego Hall of Justice Facility Modifications, requests $27.1 million one-time general fund over the next 3 fiscal years to support the JCC's estimated share of the total cost of the modernization of San Diego Hall of Justice. This is a repeat proposal. The county-owned and managed HOJ is a 14-story high-rise building with 3 underground parking levels, and that was constructed in 1996 and includes 16 courtrooms. The court occupies approximately 40% of the space in the building, and the joint occupancy agreement obligates the Judicial Council to contribute to the cost of the project. The modernization will include repairs of existing elevators, escalators, and heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems. The total estimated of the county-run project is $67,335,000. The Judicial Council's percent share of this facility is 40.24%, and that equates to $27.1 million. Proposal 2310, the trial court capital funding outlay funding. The capital program is requesting $393 million one-time general fund in 2324 for seven trial court capital outlay projects. Four projects are continuing phases and three are new starts. The request is consistent with the statewide project list that was developed in 2019 and the California five-year infrastructure plan. The request also includes a $5 million ongoing to provide resources for project assessments and program support. The five-year plan includes a total request of $3.3 billion for new starts and continuing phases for 20 projects. The upcoming new start projects include facilities for Los Angeles, Kern, and San Joaquin, and a continuing projects in San Bernardino, Fresno, Fort or Monterey, and Nevada. Happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. First of all, thank you for that presentation. And then,
Dr. Drubin, quickly on the San Diego HOJ issue, that is something that's still in front of the Department of Finance, and we've been working diligently to get them updated cost information. I think they understand the need of the project, but they've had some uncertainty of the landing on what the actual costs are. I will just sort of comment on the cap outlay, is that the last two processes, the administration has actually added and moved in advance down our five-year plan. So I think that's a great indication of their faith and trust in what we're doing, and also that we have a good plan. So just as a positive comment on what we're doing, the reassessment is a great tool, and it really provides good confidence in the administration and the legislature thus far to fund those projects.
From a timing standpoint, the governor's updates, he has two that he can make to his budget, April 1 and then at the May revision, which has been made, both obviously before your decision meeting later in May on what things going forward to BCPs.
Yeah. So that will help us, and that's why we made the decision meeting after the May revision to determine what kinds of things the administration may have and what other legislative actions would have happened between this meeting and the decision meeting.
Right. So wait a second. When in May is it?
May 18th.
May 18th. Okay, so we'll have that.
The May revision by law is no later than the 14th.
The 14th, right. Because for some reason, I have a litigation meeting on the 13th of the 12th, and I thought, wait a second.
You should be very, very good shape for all your ultimate decisions.
Okay, perfect. All right. Any questions, though, for Ms. McCormick? We did a great job going through a lot of these, and I now chair the Real Estate Policy Subcommittee of EMP, and I work closely with Ms. McCormick and her staff, and they're wonderful, so I just wanted to thank her for that. But any questions for her? None. You did great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Zlatko, can you tell us a little bit about number 11?
Number 11 is there more as a placeholder. We're not going to go into it because the governor's budget proposed exactly what we asked for. The conglomeration of budget change proposals we put together this time last year, and so looking good, and we're just hoping that it comes in. No need to go into the detail because we see it in a good place.
Outstanding. All right, and we have one of our presenters with us today in the room, and that is Ms. Speed. Ms. Speed, did you want to talk about 16 and 17?
Yes, but I move closer.
Yes, you may.
Hello. Hi.
Pleasure to see you.
Good to see you. My name is Laura Speed, presenting on items 16 and 17 on behalf of Appellate Court services. So item 16 is Proposition 66, costs in the Court of Appeal. It's funding to support new workload and costs associated with Proposition 66. It does include 14.5 new attorney positions throughout the 6 district courts of appeal. And it does have some ongoing funding for conflict counsel, storage costs, investigation costs, all related to Proposition 66. The committee has seen this before. I believe the last 2 years it has moved forward through the BCP process. However, has not made it into the governor's budget, so we are here again on that item. And then item 17, appellate court security. This is funding to provide 4 additional California Highway Patrol officers to the Judicial Protection Section for the 4 single officer courthouses in the state appellate courts. And these are these, again, courthouses that are standalone courthouses. You have also seen a version of this before, although this one is pared back significantly from previous asks, which so that's where that is. And I, Justice Hill also is chair of APJEC, if he wants to add any comments.
I would just note that with Prop 66, it's an oncoming tsunami that will hit at some point, and we hope to be ready for it, and we won't be ready if we don't have the funding, and we hope that moves along. And then the security needs, there are some deficiencies that I won't necessarily detail in a public meeting, but that have been identified that we hope to rectify. So those are the 2 proposals out of the appellate courts.
And probably exacerbated by the fact that we're now tilting up and reopening the trial courts, which is going to be also flooded with appellate courts of work.
Very much.
As we kind of work through that backlog. Okay. Any questions for Ms. Speed or the APJ or the chair of the appellate justices, Justice Hill? Anybody? We have a question from Justice Fujisaki.
But it's, again, it's like off, a little bit off topic. So funding for council appointed council is
that's in here as well.
Okay.
So there's funding for the attorney positions within the courts to do the back the ground research and that type of stuff. There's also funding for appointed counsel, and it would raise the rate that the appellate courts currently at the Supreme Court, they can pay death penalty counsel $145 an hour. This would match that, and that's what the rate was calculated at in the BCP.
And I'm sorry if I didn't. And how approximately how many counsel are we budgeting?
So we are, the cost where counsel is appointed at the trial court is not accounted for in here.
Right.
We believe the trial court costs belong to the county, or the trial court level belong to the county. For the appellate courts, we had estimated, depending on the year, and we did a different numbers in out years, starting with 10 cases per year up to 39 moving into the out years as the cases start moving through. That may be an underestimation or an overestimation. We haven't seen them come through yet, so we're adjusting as we sort of start to see it work. And so it does for appointed counsel. And there's an assumption that some of them will go to HCRC, particularly if the next item that you'll hear from HCRC were to go through. And then also for conflict counsel, if there is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we would have to have a different attorney appointed as well.
Question. Any other questions for Ms. Speed or Justice? Oh, yes, Mr. Harrigan, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Ms. Speed, did you mention that this, I think it was 17 on the security was pared back this year? And if so, can you tell us how much compared to last year?
I'm not sure of the number. The previous ask for the appellate court security was for 7 positions, and we have pared that back to only 4 positions.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Speed or Justice Hill? All right, seeing and hearing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back. All right, and from HCRC, we have John Larson. This is on item 18.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Well.
Good. Oh, should I bring the levels down?
Keep them up.
All right. Thank you for having me today. I'm here to present the Habeas Corpus Resource Center's request for 70 positions and $14.6 million general fund ongoing. Those positions would be implemented over 3 years, and it includes $450,000 in one-time funding. This is to address delays and backlogs in habeas corpus appointment and cases that are moving through the system. Give you a little more detail. In fiscal year 23-24, this request would be for 12 new attorney positions and then a number of paralegals and investigators. In 24-25, it would be 11 new attorney positions added in. And in 25-26, an additional 11 attorney positions with those concomitant paralegal and investigator positions. This is to create 15 new case teams at the Habeas Corpus Resource Center. In addition, we're requesting funds for establishing a Los Angeles office. Two reasons that are driving that predominantly are that is where most of the backlogged cases are going to proceed, especially under Prop 66 as they move through the Superior Courts. The majority of those cases emanate from the Los Angeles, Orange, Riverside, and San Bernardino County Courts. And so having access to those courts and legal talent and other people in the Los Angeles area would be beneficial. And also, the governor's pilot condemned inmate transfer pilot program, which may become permanent in the next budget, is allowing eligible incarcerated persons in condemned housing to transfer out of condemned housing to other designated institutions. And six of the seven of those institutions are in either Central or Southern California, and therefore would also be closer to a Los Angeles satellite office. And then one other note, this as you heard from Ms. Speed, this is a proposal that's similar to a request that we put forward before. The focus on our request this year is on the backlog that exists, and that's sort of absent the conditions that have changed owing to Prop 66. So in the past, we've sort of been combined into a Prop 66-driven request. This year, we're sort of looking at Prop 66 as a condition that affects the work that HCRC has to do, but it isn't the primary driver of this request. It's still the fact that there is a backlog of over 360 people who have not been appointed a habeas counsel, who are in on California's death row. And that's 54% of all condemned inmates. And quite a few of them have been waiting a long time. 73% of that number has been waiting over 10 years. And 14 of these inmates have been waiting 25 years or more for appointment of habeas counsel. So that is why we are really trying to emphasize additional resources to tackle this backlog and of the people who are have a statutory right and constitutional right to habeas counsel. So that's sort of the summary. I know that I can explain how we got to our number if you aren't interested or other questions.
All right, are there questions for Mr. Larson about item 18? Yes, Justice Fujisaki.
So is the cost of, I don't know if it's in a rental down in LA or purchase, is it, and that is calculated into?
Yes. It's their lease costs. It's calculated at a constrained footprint of about 25,000 square feet for the 70 positions. For comparison, our current lease space in San Francisco for 88 positions is 32,000 square feet. And so this is going to be smaller per person. And the pricing is based on an updated survey of the average cost of leasing space in Los Angeles area. And in the areas that we would most likely rent, which is not like the west side, it's not the most expensive areas of Los Angeles County. It's trying to get in an area that's more closer to all of the courts in the surrounding counties. But anyway, we figured it at about $43 per square foot. So it's an yearly anticipated lease cost of about $1,075,000. And that's included in the ongoing costs. And then the $450,000 is for one-time costs for furnishings and larger equipment that is not already included in the standard complement. And that was based on about 25% of our current OE&E budget.
And will you still hold on to the San Francisco office? Or?
Yes. For the time being, given that we won't know if the transfer program becomes permanent, and even if it does, it will take several years to close the Marin County facility in San Quentin, and then there would have to be if this office we would gradually reduce its footprint if necessary, and then. We would see whether we would need to keep an office here in San Francisco. We anticipate that just because of legacy cases and other issues, we would need to have some kind of a presence in Northern California.
Question? Yes.
Is it the establishment of the office in Los Angeles that requires? So the box is checked that a statutory change is required. What does that relate to?
That relates to the government code provision that caps the number of attorney positions at the HCRC at 34. And one of those positions right now is our executive director, who also works as case team supervisor, and our deputy directors, who also have case and administrative responsibilities. In order for us to be able to hire additional attorneys, that provision just needs to be amended.
Adjusted, right?
Yeah, adjusted.
Okay, thank you.
Are there questions for Mr. Larson? I'm not seeing any. Mr. Larson, thank you so much for being here and for your presentation. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. And now we're moving on to the self-help piece. We have Ms. Deppner with us.
Good afternoon. I'm Charlene Deppner. I'm director of Center for Families, Children, and the Courts. And I'm presenting on items 19 to 22. The first item is self-help centers expanding in-person, remote, and online services. The Budget Act of fiscal year 2018-19 added $19.1 million in funding for self-help centers, and fiscal year 21-22 provides for continuation of the 19.1 until fiscal year 23-24. Adding the ongoing appropriation of $12.2 million to the $19 million we have this year, this will enable the courts to continue to provide services for more than 1 million self-represented litigants. The Impact Self-Help Center expansion report submitted to the legislature in 2020 described the results of that additional $19.1 million, and it documents significant service expansion and a high rate of satisfaction of the public and the courts. Judges and court staff report that litigants who use self-help centers are better prepared, more likely to settle their cases, and if they go to court, to be better informed and less likely to have their case continued. Nonetheless, the report also documents clear litigant feedback from that more attorneys and extended hours would help cut down their waiting time for needed services. In addition, there remain many civil case types for which services are very limited, if not available at all. The State Bar Justice Gap Study found that in 2018, 50% of the Californians at all income levels experienced at least one civil legal problem in their household, yet nearly 70% of them could not access legal assistance. This proposal would request continuation of the $19.1 million, as well as an additional $26 million to the courts for self-help to enable them to provide both in-person and remote services to best meet the needs of litigants, and to expand assistance to the critical civil case types that require assistance. The proposal lists a number of services that would be provided by an additional four judicial counsel staff. I won't run through all of them, I'll just touch on them. They're increasing resources and effectiveness of self-help services in housing, consumer debt, small claims, and other civil case types. In-person and online training and technical assistance for the self-help centers, information materials for them to address common issues faced by self-represented litigants in civil cases, assistance to the courts with a program to measure customer satisfaction in real time, online resources that advise litigants about their next steps, tracking of court rules, forms, and processes so that information can be incorporated into a statewide online resource, providing courts with information from their quarterly reports and STARS database to guide their decision-making and enhance performance, and user-tested resources for self-represented litigants to understand and accomplish as much as they can on their own, including completion of simplified forms and procedures. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Deffner?
I'll just note that there's been an issue in the legislature with this funding and why it's not been made ongoing. They did request a benefit cost analysis. We did prepare one and submit it last year. There were some issues that the LAO had raised. We've been working with them and the administration on the parameters of this benefit cost analysis. I know they've made a lot of progress, so hopefully as that's completed, we can address any of those concerns, and there'll be some support for self-help funding budget cycle.
All right.
Well, I can say, since I work in my own court and Humboldt and Sonoma, the number of people that are using self-help during the last 2 years has grown enormously, just enormously.
Ms. Deffner, I just have one, I think, technical question. It's just probably my reading comprehension issue, if you could help me. On page one, it talks about the courts have identified a need for an additional $43 million, but the ask is 26 or 27, and I'm wondering, did I misread that, or?
No, you didn't. Bonnie, you want to answer that question?
Sure. I would be happy to answer that. We've actually done an internal survey since that time that suggests that perhaps the ask may, given remote, given a number of other things, it may not be quite as high as the $43 million. But I think it's one of those things that we're really going to have to develop through the budget change proposal cycle. I think the other hope is that with the additional resources that are provided on a state level, that we'll be able to minimize, you know, continue to be providing these services as efficiently as possible.
All right, thank you. That helps a lot. Any other questions on that item? All right, seeing none, go ahead to item.
Item 20 is legal support for court rules in user-friendly forms. So this proposal was developed by the three judicial council offices that routinely develop rules and forms for the judicial council, the Legal Services Office, the Criminal Justice Office, and the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts. And it requests 12 positions and $2,931,000 in general funds and 23-24 and $2,794,000 in 24-25. and ongoing funding in ongoing funding to address the legal mandate to implement new laws through court rules and forms and provide user-friendly forms and tools that advance the judicial council, the judicial branch's commitment to remove barriers to court access and case completion. The California Constitution charges the Judicial Council to adopt rules of court administration and practice and procedure. A significant element of adopting rules includes developing accompanying court forms. Litigants use court forms to communicate details about their cases to the court, and traditionally, court forms were written for attorneys to complete. But today, litigants representing themselves need forms that are written in legally accurate, plain language, forms that are translated, forms that are accessible to those with disabilities. And that is the second piece of our mission. Superior courts are required to accept these statewide forms and when they are filed. And our experience is that when these forms are user-friendly, as that's a global term we've used, the legal process goes more swiftly and less likely to be continued. All three of the offices that developed this proposal follow the same process for developing forms, which is in the council's forms manual. And so that extends from the initial analysis of the legislation to drafting, review by relevant advisory bodies, invitation to comment, analysis of public comment, and the final form that goes to the Judicial Council. So in each one of these steps, there are analysts who are working on actually the coding to develop the forms, but also there needs to be input and legal review of each of them to make sure it remains legally accurate as we go through the process. The number of newly mandated forms and forms requiring revision steadily increased from 88 in 2013 to 201 in 2020, an increase of 128%. All offices responsible for developing rules and forms are currently working at capacity. Legislation has also created a need to broker expertise in our attorney workforce, primarily in the areas of conservatorship, juvenile justice, domestic violence, family and small claims, and unlawful detainer and criminal and traffic cases. The demand for court forms is high and rising. The top 10 fillable forms on the Judicial Council branch website were downloaded 2,031,000 times in 2020 alone. The Center for Families, Children in the Courts and Criminal Justice Services have staff, about 90% of the people who are assigned to work on forms also have other assignments. And this is creating a backlog and tension with other core legal assignments, such as legal subject matter expertise on projects in other offices and working groups, technical assistance and counsel of the courts, data analytics, and multidisciplinary education. The technology for increased access is available, but we lack the legal workforce consistently provide legally accurate and plain language content that is aligned with the legislation in a timely manner. The proposal includes a chart that is a workload analysis of the that finds that 12 that we need 12 additional attorneys, and it takes the process one by one, shows you each of the classifications that are involved in preparation at any given time and the amount of time that it takes to develop these forms. I see Michael is online. Michael Gidden, would you like to comment further?
Good afternoon, Judge Rubin and the Budget Committee. I'm Michael Gidden. I'm here on behalf of Legal Services, but also to address what a significant program this is. Judicial Council forms are one of the council's most high-profile programs, affecting every single court and almost every single litigant, both represented and self-represented as well. I want to speak up because I want to be clear that this is not, we're used to having Ms. Deppner here as representing CFCC. Here she's representing three offices because this program crosses 8 or 9 advisory committees that are staffed by 3 different offices. We work together all the time. We're trying to fulfill statutory mandates, and to say we are working at capacity is an understatement. Those of you who've been on committees that have seen rules and forms know that you are getting reports from staff at 10 o'clock on weeknights, on weekends. We're doing everything we can to fulfill these statutory mandates that are so necessary to comply with the law and to allow litigants and courts to comply with the law. But we need more staff. We are also trying to address all the technology changes that are aligned with forms, including accessibility. They are getting more and more difficult to create, and it requires a very special partnership between form and content. Between these are legal documents, but there's a great partnership that the attorneys who are working with the committees who are drafting these forms have with their technical and analytic assistants. So I think that's enough from me. But if there are any questions, Ms. Deppner, I think would be able to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Gidden or Ms. Deppner on the forms item? I'm seeing none, but Mr. Gidden, it's always a pleasure to see you, and Ms. Deppner has another one to do, which is the language access efforts in California. Thank you, Mr. Gidden.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This proposal requests 2 positions and $585,000 general fund for fiscal year 23-24 and $516 million ongoing general fund for fiscal year 24-25. The proposal addresses the shortage of qualified court interpreters and supports the strategic plan for the language access in California courts. Addressing the pandemic impact on available testing is one of the main objectives of this request. In 2020, the pandemic forced a halt to all in-person court interpreter testing. And in 2021, only limited staggered testing was available in 4 certified languages, Spanish, Vietnamese, Korean, and Mandarin. New staff would increase the interpreter pool by implementing improved strategies to recruit and train court interpreters, as well as improvements in court interpreter testing designed to expand the number of examination passers. New staff would also support the Court Interpreter Data Collection System, CIDCS, a system developed in 2004 with limited modern functionality and requiring manual adjustments. Staff would also work with IT on the development of standard platforms for CIDCS that will improve court services, such as scheduling interpreter assignments, tracking in-person and remote interpreting assignments, serving a greater number of system users, permitting payment and remote access to training and other services, and tracking the performances of performance metrics. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Deppner? Yes, Judge Hoff.
Yeah, my impression is that the average age of our interpreters is kind of going up, and that we're not bringing in enough young people to kind of replace the older people that are providing that service. Is that correct? And how would this proposal address that?
That is correct. We have a number of interpreters who are approaching a retirement age and some who have passed. The problem that we had in getting testing done during the pandemic has obviously made it difficult for people to test and join the interpreter workforce. And in addition, as we'll note in my last presentation, we have been experimenting with something called near passer training, that is finding out people who almost passed the test but did not, and offering them extra training so that they can pass the test. And our preliminary results shows that is an amazingly successful strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you. More questions for Ms. Deffner on item 21? All right, seeing none. What about item 22?
Okay, this is a request to increase the expenditure authority for the Court Interpreters Fund from $156,000 to $356,000 a year. Now, the Court Interpreters Fund is a restricted revenue fund that is different from, than the Court Interpreters Program Fund, which funds the interpreters. Pursuant to Government Code Section 68.562, the Court Interpreter Revenue Fund was established in 2002, and it has no provisions for us to make these adjustments any other way than to submit a VCP to adjust the funding. The fund can be used to support interpreter functions and services, including recruitment, testing, training, continuing education and evaluation, which are all things that we need. And the current expenditure authority of $156,000 annually, which is what has been identified in the Budget Act, is the maximum that could be spent in, from the revenue fund and until we adjust, make it, we request the ability to make those adjustments in conjunction with the budget services staff. Under the proposal, the expenditure authority would be raised from $156,000 to $356,000 for 5 years only. And we would be using that primarily for addressing the shortage of qualified interpreters, near passers, and new applicants in the bilingual interpreting examination. Also under this proposal is a provision that would add the flexibility to a request to adjust spending authority in the future should that be needed. Following the 5-year spend down, the annual expenditures would be adjusted back to $156,000 or an appropriate level, which we would work with budget services to establish. I just want to add that our court interpreter and language access offices have done spectacular work this year to get our recruitment process online, to enhance training, and to offer testing. And this money would make it possible for them to escalate and accelerate the benefits of that investment. Any questions?
Any questions from Ms. Deffner on the last one? I'm seeing no questions. Ms. Deffner, thank you so much for your presentation. And and obviously, if we have any questions in the interim between now and the next meeting, somebody might shoot you a couple. But thank you for your explanations today.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, that concludes our review of the BCCs. Let me just ask staff if they want to. Thing here. Did you have anyone who contributed for the review of these for today?
I don't think for me, Judge Rubin, it's been an informative session up to this point, and more deliberation necessary as we go forward.
Okay, good news. All right. So let me just ask the members that if you do think of a question, because as 90% of the time you leave the room and say, oh, well, I'm right. Just go ahead and shoot an email to Ms. Cowan or Zlatko or Ms. Mueller, and they will send it out to where it needs to go, and we'll get answers before next time.
Yeah. Now that we've completed these presentations, if there are other questions you have amongst yourselves, help, more than happy to do that. But again, if you have questions otherwise, just send it Angela's way, and we'll get the teams that presented today to get back to you so that you have all the information you need for our decision-making meeting in May.
Outstanding. Thank you. That does conclude our open meeting. If there's no further business, I'm going to adjourn us and move us into our closed session. And seeing no further questions, we're going to go into our closed session. I guess we just need, we need to keep Mr. Harrigan, but we should shut the video down.